versus Wormuth. Counsel for appellant, please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, good morning. My name is Mateo Caballero, and I represent plaintiff appellant Stephen Crow in the case. With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, counsel, the time shown on the clock is your total time remaining.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Plaintiff appellant Stephen Crow is a bisexual disabled veteran with multiple tours of service in the Middle East. With an otherwise unblemished public service career of 7 years, he was terminated from his federal job as a police officer at the Tripler Army Medical Center based on a fishing expedition conducted by fellow officer Kevin Oda. Oda had called plaintiff anti-gay slurs, namely, and with apologies to the court and the audience, fag and faggot, on multiple occasions prior to the conducting this investigation. In fact, said investigation was conducted just 2 months after plaintiff had complained to the leadership at the provost marshal office about Oda's slurs.
But counsel,
Yes.
The investigation was done by, is it Chow? But the decision to terminate was made by someone other than him, right?
Yes, the decision to terminate was made by someone else.
It was Oda. Oda is the investigator that you're complaining about.
Yes.
And so, but he was directed in the investigation specifically as to whom to interview, correct?
Well, Your Honor, we don't know exactly what happened in terms of why he interviewed all these people. The initial allegations against plaintiff here were that he had unprofessional conduct towards a single person, and then that all of a sudden entailed interviewing a bunch of other people who were not witnesses to that original allegation. And what we maintain, Your Honor, here is that Oda definitely played a role on the investigation and influenced that investigation. So under these court's cases, specifically the case Dominguez Caribbean Nevada Transportation Department, the question is whether Oda's animus, and here there is sufficient evidence of animus on the part of Oda, who called plaintiff, again, those slurs on multiple occasions, whether Oda's animus influenced the investigation and ultimately influenced the decision making.
What evidence is there of that? Because you know, it seems the Army had the investigation uncovered some misconduct on your client's part, and the Army decided that was the basis that they claim that was the basis for the termination. And your argument is that, well, Oda had this animus, and that's what sort of produced all of this. But what is the evidence of that?
Well, the evidence that the Oda's animus influenced investigation is threefold. First, he didn't focus, again, on the allegations at hand, which were that single instance of a professional conduct against someone, but instead he interviewed a bunch of other people, and he was the one who was asking these questions of those witnesses.
Right, unreasonable? I mean, once you start going down a path of investigating an employee and you speak to different people, sometimes you learn new things that you have to follow up on.
That is correct, but even some of the questions asked here, you know, there was the initial interview with Mr. Sewell, the complainant, and then the very next interview, he was already asking questions that had nothing to do with the investigation, such things as, have you heard of plaintiff having sex at work? And at that point, there was no evidence that plaintiff was, in fact, having sex at work. So I think there are questions about how the investigation was conducted, but it's not just the scope of the investigation that we argue Oda had influence over. It's also in terms of how, you know, the type of evidence that was used, because even though plaintiff here was accused of having sex at work on multiple occasions, Oda essentially didn't review camera footage, didn't try to determine whether, you know, plaintiff was, for example, missing in action and people couldn't find him. There was no corroborating evidence here about, you know, when he was having sex at work, or even a single instance where he had sex at work, making it very difficult for plaintiff to defend himself against these allegations.
But counsel, you're disregarding the testimony of the individual who admitted having sex with Mr. Crow at work.
Yes, Your Honor, because she recanted the testimony and then only re-recanted her recantation when she was threatened by the U.S. Army with termination. So we are arguing, Your Honor, that that second recantation was essentially coerced by the U.S. Army here.
Well, wasn't that a decision that had to be made by the ALJ in determining how much credibility to give her statements?
Not under Title VII, Your Honor. Under Title VII, plaintiff is entitled to a trial de novo on his discrimination claims. Under the Title V, sure, you know, there is some, you know, deference that is given to the AJ, but on the Title VII claim.
That's another procedural point that we have to get to, whether or not this was a Title VII case or whether or not this was an appeal from the board.
Well, it was both, Your Honor. There were the Title VII claims that plaintiff brought here, and those are essentially separated into two claims. The pre-termination claim is based on the adverse actions that were taken pre-termination, such as placing him in on administrative duty, denying him overtime. And those claims, Your Honor, plaintiff couldn't have brought before the MSPB because the MSPB didn't have jurisdiction over such claims. And then you have the wrongful termination claim based on discrimination and retaliation. And that claim, you know, was brought before the MSPB. Those claims were brought before the MSPB and resolved by the AJ. Those are still titles. Go ahead.
Well, it seems like what you want to do is separate these two sets of claims, right? You want to say there's termination claims and then there's some other claims. Can you do that under the regulations? Because this is a complicated scheme that we're looking at here, but it seems that these are all related together. These aren't really distinct. It's all the same basic course of conduct that leads to a suspension and then eventually a termination.
Not only you're allowed under the regulations, Your Honor, you're required under the regulations. The Merit Systems Protection Board has limited jurisdiction here and can only resolve very specific types of adverse actions, termination being one of them. But for pre-termination claims, each one of those adverse actions has to be analyzed separately. And yes,
are you pointing to for that? Because is there a case or a part of the regulation that you're referring to?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that it's the scheme of the regulation itself that has mixed case appeals that go to before the MSPB, and the mixed case appeal that goes before the MSPB concerns plaintiff's termination. And in those situations, you can bring as an affirmative defense to the termination, essentially discrimination. But you cannot bring, and the regulations do not allow plaintiff here to go before the MSPB and argue adverse actions that over which the agency doesn't have jurisdiction.
Counsel, may I ask you, for the Title VII claims, generally before there is a Title VII cause of action, one must receive a right to sue letter. Was that done
here
in this case?
So in this case, Your Honor, a plaintiff first went to the agency, filed an EEO complaint with the agency, which eventually ended up before the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
Correct.
And then he amended that complaint to include the termination once he received the notice of termination. What happened next is he filed an appeal with the MSPB, which dismissed the appeal because it said, look, we have a mixed case complaint.
Correct.
Pending before the EOC, so we don't have jurisdiction, dismissed it. And then the next thing plaintiff did is he filed a motion, unopposed motion, to sever his termination claims from his pre-termination claims before the EOC.
Correct.
And then after that, he filed with the MSPB a mixed case appeal. What was pending before the EEOC, once he severed his termination claim, were his pre-termination claims.
Correct.
And here, the statute is very clear that once those those claims were never dismissed by the EEOC, by the way, and once those claims languished in the before the EEOC for 180 days, the statute provides plaintiff the opportunity to go to district court even without a right to sue letter.
What case says that you don't need a right to sue letter in a Title VII case once the 180 days have lapsed? What case says that?
It's not by case, Your Honor. It's by statute. And we argue this, and we cite the statute in our briefs, that essentially once 180 days have passed, it's essentially like a deemed denial that the EEOC hasn't made that decision. And in any event, here, Your Honor,
this is an important point. Once the 180 days have passed with no action, then the claimant has the right to request a right to sue letter, but not just to go into court without a right to sue letter, because the right to sue letter is what gives you access to the court. And cases say that pretty plainly.
Your Honor, with all due respect, that's not what the statute says.
Which statute? Are you talking about 2000E, or are you talking about the board statute? Because the board statute doesn't apply in this scenario when you're trying to assert Title VII claims after going to the EEOC. We're in the 2000E arena, not the board statute.
Sure, Your Honor. It's 42 U.S.C. section 2000E-16C, which says, after 180 days from the filing of the initial charge with the department, agency, or unit, an employee or applicant for employment, if aggrieved by the failure to take action on his complaint, may file a civil action as provided in section 2000E-5 of this title.
And so what does 2000E-5 say?
It says that you may file a claim for discrimination or retaliation in district court.
It doesn't say anything about a right to sue letter.
I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor.
Okay.
I can look at it and in rebuttal
address
the issue.
Can we come back to the MSPB, the mixed case aspect of this, the exhaustion piece? Because it seems that what you want to do is divide the world up into pre-termination and termination. I guess I'm still wondering where you're pointing to in the case law or the regulation that tells us you can do that. Because once there is a adverse employment action, then the MSPB has some amount of jurisdiction. And the question here to me is, how far does that extend? And you want to draw the line at pre-termination, termination. The problem is that the case law and the regulation talk more about relatedness or connected to, and here we have a kind of related course of conduct. These aren't really separate.
Well, Your Honor, some of them are separate. For example, you have claims for overtime denial, and we would argue those are entirely separate from the termination. But in terms of the statute and regulation, you know, 5 CFR section 1201.3A, you know, does make distinctions between mixed case appeals and mixed case complaints, and they're clearly very different types of creatures, and they're not the same, they're not equivalent, and there is nothing in the MSPB regulation or statute that confers a jurisdiction over adverse actions that are not listed as part of the jurisdiction of the MSPB. So there is no way for plaintiff here, for example, to say that the investigation itself or that his placement on administrative duty was itself discriminatory or retaliatory. They wouldn't be able to make that argument or settle those claims before the MSPB. And if I may just reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, I see I only have a couple of minutes.
All right, thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court, Assistant United States Attorney Edric Ching, appearing on behalf of Christine Wormuth, Secretary of the Army. In response to counsel's argument with regard to the exhaustion matter, the government or the Army relies upon the McAdams case, which really focuses on whether the allegations in the EEO case and the MSPB case are related. At the district court level, Mr. Crow and his counsel did not address this argument. In this case, it is clear that the EEO proceeding and the allegations brought before the MSPB are actually very related.
Counsel, why then would the board say it couldn't hear the case because it had already been brought before the EEO? This is very confusing procedurally.
Yes.
Why did the board say that it couldn't hear those claims if they're related?
Time hadn't passed? Is that the...
Yeah, you know, I'm not exactly sure why the board did that, Your Honor. However, there were...
That's very confusing.
Well, didn't the board do it because he had already filed in the EEO? I mean, you can't have two cases going in the same place, and the regulation says wherever you file first is where you start with, and so the MSPB saw he had this EEO complaint going, and they told him to go pursue that. His response to that was to try to dismiss part of that and then to bring some of this back to the MSPB, but to keep some of it parked in front of the EEO. And the question here is, can you do
the
that?
The problem was still there because he still had claims pending in the EEOC when he came back to the board. So why would the board then proceed with those claims if the position was he had already filed with the EEOC? That's really confusing to me.
Yes, Your Honor. You know, with regard to this case, there were pre-hearing telephonic conferences. You know, I believe that was attached to our concise statement of facts, in which the MSPB administrative law judge, you know, they had a conference and they requested or they discussed what affirmative defenses would be raised. And at that point, Mr. Kroll only raised the sexual orientation discrimination. So at that point, it was his, you know, he had the opportunity to raise additional affirmative defenses. He chose not to. He abandoned it, and therefore he failed to exhaust his administrative remedies as to
the. So what does that mean in terms of the claims that were still pending before the EEOC?
Well, I think in this case, per McAdams, he was required to bring all related claims in front of the MSPB, and by not doing so, he therefore waived or abandoned.
What's the definition of a related claim?
I believe in the McAdams case, Your Honor, with regard to related claims, it's the similar, whether the claims are similar, whether the witnesses would be similar. And in this case, both the claims brought before the EEO and the MSPB would have involved the removal of Mr. Kroll.
But he said he had some claims that did not involve removal. That's the problem, like hostile work environment claims and vacation time, and those are not the same.
Yes, but Your Honor, this was not raised before at the district court level. But I believe if it was raised, it would have involved Captain Ballesteros, and Captain Ballesteros's response to various requests made by Mr. Kroll. So it would have involved the same witnesses, and it would have involved the same set of facts which caused all this. All of his claims to, with regard to, for example, vacation time and everything. Everything arose out of this investigation.
Okay, can I ask the question in a different way?
Yes.
Is the point that he had to bring the pre-termination claims that Judge Bress was referring to, he had to bring them to the board, and he didn't? Is that the problem here?
Yes, Your Honor. Per McAdams, he was required to bring all related claims before the board. He had the opportunity to do so. This was not a case, for example, that he tried to raise it before the administrative law judge and they denied him. He made the choice not to raise it.
And as I understand it, the board originally dismissed because the 120 days hadn't passed while the case was pending.
Yes.
And so then after that passed, correct me if I'm wrong here, but after that time passed, he tried to bypass the board and go with the other claims to the district court. Is that?
Yes. He had the opportunity to raise these claims before the MSPB.
And he didn't.
Yeah, they chose not to, Your Honor, correct.
And that's why this was dismissed for failure to exhaust?
Yes. Yeah, so the the Army relies upon McAdams. You know, we acknowledge it's an Eighth Circuit case. At the district court level, Mr. Kroll did not address the McAdams case, rather just relied upon the argument by going to the EEOC they exhausted.
Can I go back just in this train of thought to a question Judge Rawlinson had been asking, which is a question I have too. So the first time he goes to the MSPB, they essentially, you know, raise the yellow flag and say, wait a minute here, you're already pursuing this in the EEO, you need to do something about that. He comes back to the MSPB, but of course he still had something pending in front of the EEO. Did the MSPB know that? Were they aware that there were dual proceedings going on? Because somehow, initially, they were aware, and they told him, you can't bring this in two places at once. Then he goes and basically does it again. And so my question is, when he goes back a second time, was the MSPB on notice that he had actually two claims going in two different places? Does the record show anything about this?
You know, Your Honor, that's a very good question, but I'm unsure of the answer to that question. But the Army's position is that, you know, at that point, you know, that there were conferences held, you know, they were discussed as to what affirmative defenses were going to be brought, you know, in with regard to the ALJ proceeding, and that the Army, I mean, that Mr. Crowell chose not to bring it.
And in your view, that the pre-termination related claims were also affirmative defenses to the termination? They all sort of rolled up together? Is that your position?
Yes, because I believe that Mr. Crowell is claiming that some of these claims were actually part of his retaliation claim in relation to him, you know, contacting the EEO counselor or doing protected activity.
Counsel, you're relying on the McAdams case, which is an Eighth Circuit case. Is there a Ninth Circuit case that supports your argument that you're making?
I could not find any, Your Honor. But with regard to, you know, the Eighth Circuit's, I guess the policy behind it is, you know, if there are going to be two different proceedings and there's going to be the same witnesses and the same claims, I'm assuming that the Eighth Circuit was looking at this and thinking, well, I think it's better to have everything in one forum when everything's related, maybe for efficiency purposes, resources, and also to maybe avoid inconsistent results.
But is that consistent with the statute under which the board operates?
Yes, and Your Honor, if the other thing I would like to point out to you is that Deputy Provost Marshal Ingesbretson's memorandum to Mr. Crowell, I believe in the memorandum it gave him three options of how to proceed, and option one was proceed to the MSPB, option one was EEO, option two was MSPB, and I believe option three was the Office of Special Counsel for some kind of whistleblower claim if he had any. So it was made clear to Mr. Crowell at that point, right, that he had options, option one, option two, or option three. You know, he wasn't able to proceed in both forums. And especially, Your Honor, in this case, especially when the claims are so interrelated, you know, with the claims being similar with regard to the removal, the witnesses being the same and everything, I think it was required per McAdams of Mr. Crowell to proceed to bring all of his claims before the MSPB.
Do you agree that the board has limited jurisdiction?
Yes, it does have limited jurisdiction, Your Honor, but with regard to the MSPB has the jurisdiction with regard to, like, for the most part, removal cases. However, per McAdams, you know, if the claims are related, it does have the jurisdiction to consider.
Well, the problem is that's an Eighth Circuit case, and
yes.
So if we would have to agree to adopt out of circuit precedent to get to that. But so that's what concerns me about relying on that case to say simply because they were related, they can go before the board when the board is a body of limited jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the test for relatedness? I mean, is it the same events? Is it whether the events would be part of the affirmative defense? Because, you know, here, if just hypothetically, if he had some completely different issue 2 years before all of this other stuff, I don't think we would say it's really related. Here, the difficulty is it temporally and subject matter-wise, it is kind of about the same general course of conduct.
Yes, with regard to the related test, I believe the test would consider whether the same witnesses are going to be called in both cases, whether the claims are actually similar. And in this case, actually the main claim was the removal, and that was actually raised before the EEO and the MSPB. So in this case, like Your Honor just referenced, you know, I believe everything arose out of the removal with regard to his retaliation claim.
But didn't he have some other claims, hostile work environment, and some leave, some other issues Did those all arise out of the same circumstances?
Yes, but the hostile work environment was raised, Your Honor, but then the Mr. Kroll did not raise that at the district court level when we brought our motion for summary judgment, and therefore he waived that argument. Your Honor, I'd just like to, if we can, do you have any, is it okay if I move on to a different subject
matter? That's fine.
Okay. With regard to one of our arguments is that Mr. Kroll did not address numerous arguments made by the Army and the Army's motion for summary judgment at the district court level. There's about seven different arguments that we raise. One of the biggest ones is that with regard to the McDonnell-Douglas test, Mr. Kroll did not raise any arguments or even challenge the Army's argument that the reasons for the removal and his personnel decisions were legitimate and non-discriminatory. Mr. Kroll did not address whether or try to even argue that these reasons were pretext. In addition, Mr. Kroll did not raise any arguments with regard to the applicability of McAdams. looking at the pleadings with regard to the motion for summary judgment, Mr. Kroll did not. He simply argued that Oda was biased. He never argued that his bias, or I'm sorry, he argued that Oda was biased and he controlled the investigation. It's clear in this case that this investigation was not controlled by Officer Oda. Captain Ballesteros was told by his superiors to start an investigation. Captain Ballesteros informed Oda exactly which witnesses to interview. He even gave the questions to interview with regard to his interview of Mr. Sewell. And Officer Ballesteros, or Captain Ballesteros, also interviewed probably the main witness to be interviewed, and that's Mr. Kroll, and he had two interviews of him. After Captain Ballesteros made his notice of proposed removal, then Deputy Provost Marshal Ingus Preston, he made an independent review similar to Captain Ballesteros, and he affirmed or he adopted the proposal to remove Mr. Kroll. Mr. Kroll cites some cases with regard to his failure to raise arguments, or his failure to raise arguments at the district court level. The Polaris-Galan case, in that case, the claim was made of what was an aggravated felony for deportation purposes. The defendant in that case raised an alternative argument on an existing claim. The Puerta case contained a similar argument, but new legal authorities. And in this case, it is clear that there's numerous arguments not raised by Mr. Kroll at the district court level. Just briefly, Your Honor, I don't have 30 seconds, but Mr. Kroll attempts to kind of mishmash the motion for summary judgment and the title, and then the removal portion of the case. For example, at the top of page 8, Mr. Kroll argues he has a block paragraph that says that supports his defense to the motion for summary judgment. However, that portion was actually in the Title V briefings. That was not admissible evidence pursuant to Rule 56 and cannot be considered in relation to the motion for summary judgment. And I think I'm done, Your Honor, if you have any more questions of me.
It appears not. Thank you, Counsel. Rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to address three things about the exhaustion of administrative remedies here. The first one, as to the claims, again, there are pre-termination claims and termination claims. Both the statute and regulation do not talk about relatedness. Instead, they talk about the type of adverse action over which either the MSPB has jurisdiction or the EOC or the agency has jurisdiction. So the statute and regulations focus on the type of adverse action, not necessarily on whether they're related or not. That comes from the McAdams case.
Could you delineate for us the pre-termination actions that you are asserting in this case?
Sure. You have first the investigation itself as an adverse action. Then you have the placement on administrative duty. Then you have the denial of overtime. Then you have the notice of proposed removal, and that's it. Those are the pre-termination adverse actions at issue here. And then, by the way, one of the reasons why the MSPB proceeded the second time plaintiff filed his case with MSPB is because there are actually guidance under the MSPB saying that what he did was right, that you cannot bring, the MSPB would not, doesn't have jurisdiction over pre-termination claims, so there was no way for him to bring his entire case before the MSPB. That's just
him?
Not.
Is this guidance you're saying they gave him at the time?
This is just written guidance they have on cases like this where there are mixed cases.
Is that guidance cited in the brief somewhere?
It is not cited in the brief, Your Honor, but it is available and we can provide it to the court later if the court wants us to. But there was nothing improper about what they did, and that's why it wasn't dismissed. And I know I'm out of time, but the last point I want to make about McAdams very quickly is that McAdams is distinguishable from this case because there was a mixed case complaint pending before the EOC before the EOC when plaintiff in that case filed his mixed case appeal. Here, that wasn't the case. There was a non-mixed case pending. And as explained McAdams, and this is a quote, the EOC regulations provide for the cancellation of a mixed case complaint if such appeal is timely filed. Here, there was no mixed case complaint pending before the EOC when plaintiff filed his second appeal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case just argued is submitted for a decision by the court. The next case on calendar for argument is USA Fanta Corporation versus Imperial Pacific International.